I'm Martha McCallum, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Tuesday, April 24th, 2018. I'm Lisa Brady. The suspect in the deadly Tennessee Waffle House shooting had a history of bizarre behavior, but he still got guns.
Mental illness is a real problem in society, and these sort of shootings that are occurring are mostly being done by people that are mentally ill.
I'm Dave Anthony. How do you get to the bottom of anything in Syria?
You can only trace for many of these nerve agents for up to 2 weeks afterwards.
And I'm Jessica Tarlov. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
The man accused of killing four people at a Waffle House in a Nashville suburb Sunday is now in custody, captured in the woods near an apartment complex Monday.
The description that we had received was a maroon shirt, dark jeans, and a backpack, which is exactly what he had on.
And Metro Nashville Police Lieutenant Carlos Lara says Travis Reinking was still armed, a semi-automatic weapon found in the backpack he was wearing. Police were acting on a tip.
They got a call from someone near that apartment complex that someone matching the suspect's description was walking in that area.
Fox's Jonathan Sari is in Antioch.
And then when they arrived, there were some construction workers on site who started pointing towards the wooded area. The police, a group of detectives, walked into that woods down some trails, and they noticed this man walking with black pants and a maroon shirt, which was one of the descriptions that had been put out, particularly those black pants, and wearing a backpack. And so he turned around. They immediately recognized him, and that's when they ordered him to hit the ground.
Have police confirmed much yet about where the weapon came from at the restaurant or about the other weapons previously taken away from Travis Reinking?
Yeah, he had a long history with law enforcement. He first appeared on their radar around 2016, or really a little bit before that. There was an incident at a public swimming pool where he exposed himself and allegedly tried to provoke the lifeguards into a fight. In 2016, authorities in Tazewell County, Illinois, reported that Reinking was, quote, delusional, and that he was claiming that he was being stalked by singer Taylor Swift. But they really became concerned the following year, the following summer, when he was arrested by Secret Service for allegedly refusing to leave a secure area near the White House. After that, authorities seized his firearms. They placed them in the custody of his father. Police say the father promised that he would look after the firearms, keep them away from his son. But police say at some point, the father eventually returned the weapons to his son, including the same AR-15, police say, that was used in the Sunday morning shooting at the Waffle House. And for that reason, police say the father may potentially face federal firearm charges if they can prove that he knowingly gave firearms to someone who was not authorized to possess them.
Mark W. Smith is a constitutional attorney.
When you're buying or selling or taking possession of guns or transferring guns, you have to comply not only with the federal law, but you also have to comply with the relevant state law, which could be your state's laws, or it could be another state in which you're in if you happen to be doing something with guns in that other state.
Is it difficult to get approval from a judge, or do you need a judge's approval to take away someone's weapons?
It depends on the state. Under federal law, certain people are not allowed to possess firearms under any set of circumstances. Those are people that are convicted of felonies, which is defined as a crime punishable by imprisonment of more than a year, if you're a fugitive from justice, or if you're an unlawful user or addicted to, let's say, controlled substances. But what's in this case, Lisa, relevant, is if you're a person who's been adjudicated as mentally defective or has been admitted to a mental institution, then you're not allowed to have guns. And every state has a civil commitment law that, as you know, your listeners may understand, if someone is a danger to himself or her or to others, there's a process in every state to have them civilly committed to a mental institution for treatment. But what often happens is people don't bother taking that step.
There are some states that have been working on ways to make it easier for the public or a family member to intervene in some way that doesn't necessarily mean having them committed. For instance, in Arizona, there's a bill proposed that would allow police, family members, others to request a judge to order an evaluation on whether someone is a danger. And I think Florida worked on something similar after the Parkland school shooting. Is that something that, multiple states are working on?
There are potential laws, and some states actually have these laws, and they're referred to generally as red flag statutes, or sometimes they're called extreme risk protection orders. And the idea behind these is if someone thinks that you are, a danger to himself or to the neighborhood, then they can call the police up and say, look, I think this guy or this gal is potentially violent and dangerous, and I think something needs to be done. And based on that sworn out complaint, the police can come to the house and take the guns away. And then after that, they have a hearing before the judge. But the problem with these red flag laws is they really do jeopardize due process, because it allows, you know, let's say hypothetically, Lisa, someone who doesn't like someone else can make a false statement and say, look, I think this person's suicidal, or I think this person is a danger to society, or who knows what. And then based on that alone, the police can go and take the guns away from the person, and it's very expensive and time-consuming for the person to get the guns back and to have the hearing, even if he or she has done nothing wrong and it was just simply, you know, a neighbor that wasn't happy with that person.
The suspected Tennessee gunman, Travis Ryan King, had his guns taken away after a security incident at the White House last year, but ultimately those guns were given back into the custody, if you will, of Ryan King's father. And the father gave the guns back to him in the end. So now there's a lot of scrutiny on the father and whether he could face charges for that.
Under state law, again, we don't know which law is going to apply here. Did this individual get his guns from his father in Illinois? Did he get the guns from his father in Tennessee? Presumably he got it in Illinois. And under Illinois law, it's not clear that they have any kind of law like aiding and abetting or whatnot that would prohibit the turning over of the gun to the son. And again, we also don't know really, you know, as a practical matter, how did that happen? You know, did the did the father have the guns in a closet and then the son took them from the closet? Did the father actually hand the guns to the son? You can get into very fact-specific questions about, well, how exactly did the father, if he did at all, turn the gun over to the son, and what did the father know about what the son could or could not do? So I think, again, it's very fact-specific in these situations, Lisa, and only time will tell as to what happened. But he may have violated some laws, or he may not have.
So, Jonathan, during your time in Antioch, have you heard a lot of people talking about the man who got the gun away from the shooter at the restaurant?
Yeah, James Shaw Jr. Everyone is calling him a hero, except for James Shaw Jr.
I just knew it was me or him or that type of scenario. So I chose to go with what I wanted to go with, and it worked.
He was in that Waffle House as a customer eating when the gunman came in, started firing. Shaw said initially he tried to run for cover, but then he saw the gunman. He couldn't tell if his weapon had jammed and he was trying to unjam it or if he was just trying to reload it. Whatever the case, the gunman was looking down at his weapon. Mr. Shaw lunged at the gunman and grabbed the weapon away from him, the rifle, and then threw it over the counter. The gunman then fled the building on foot. And again, Mr. Shaw is saying he's not a hero because when he's very honest about his motives, he says initially it was self-preservation. He just wanted to save his own skin so that he could get home and be with his four-year-old daughter, be there for her, tuck her into bed every night. But everyone else is saying he's a hero. And the police are saying if he hadn't reacted the way he did, the gunman would have reloaded and continued shooting, and potentially more people would have been injured, if not killed.
Jonathan Sary in Antioch, Tennessee, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
This is Jessica Tarlov with your Fox News commentary coming up.
It is almost impossible to imagine what it's like to live in a war zone. The people of Syria have been enduring that for years. Millions have fled the civil war there. But for those still residing in Douma, a rebel-held area, it got a lot worse 2 weeks ago. A poison gassing.
The evil and the despicable attack left mothers and fathers, infants and children, thrashing in pain and gasping for air.
President Trump called Syria's leader a monster. And backed by the UK and France,
I ordered the United States Armed Forces to launch precision strikes on targets associated with the chemical weapons capabilities of Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad.
Assad and his Russian allies deny there was such an attack and made it difficult for international inspectors from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons to get into Douma to investigate.
We've been here for a couple of days up and down the Syrian border talking to people who were caught up in that attack, people who survived, who fled north, people who are still down in the affected areas. We're not just learning about the horrors that went on that night on 7th of April, but also about the concerted effort by Russia and Syria to cover up this attack.
That was Fox's Benjamin Hall reporting from Turkey last week.
The Syrian regime has actually found the graves of the victims from that attack. They have taken the bodies so they cannot be tested. And we also know that doctors who were treating those victims have been harassed severely. Their families have been threatened. But we do know from rebel commanders across the border in Syria that Americans have visited them. They have taken urine and blood samples from survivors who escaped.
Benjamin Hall is now back in Fox's London bureau and joins us to talk about what he saw and what he learned.
We flew out there as soon as we could, and liaising with a number of rebel groups in the north and some Syrian opposition groups, we were able to make contact with some of these survivors. And although we weren't able to cross the border into Syria itself, we were fortunate enough to meet some of the survivors as they came across. And so we spoke to people who had both been there that night, had witnessed the atrocities, had seen the women and the children in hospital choking with white foam coming out of their mouths. We'd also spoken to people who were still in the area, and we'd spoken to a number of doctors who treated those victims. So we got a pretty good idea of what it was all like. And, you know, if you go to these border areas of Syria and Turkey, that's where the stories flow out of the country. And so if you're there long enough, if you've worked in the region long enough, you make contacts. And we were able to do just that and luckily bring the report back for our viewers.
We're going to play one of the survivors you spoke to, what he told you about the gas attack.
One had broken the roof and was stuck. Everybody in that house and at least two other houses had died. The barrel was about 5 feet long, yellow and made of thick metal. Doctors said they only had room to treat those who had a chance of survival. They left the others to die.
How was he? Was he injured in this?
He was partly injured. He had felt the effects of this gas, but he was in one of the buildings nearby, not one of the ones that was hit by these barrel bombs. He was on the scene very soon afterwards, and he brought with him photos of the barrel bombs in the buildings because he immediately went to try and help his friends who lived nearby. And what we actually saw from the pictures he showed us were these very crude barrel bombs, which the Assad regime is notorious for using. They are indiscriminate, and they cannot be targeted, and that's one of the horrors of this story.
So they just drop these from the sky, and they just go wherever.
They roll them out of helicopters. The Assad regime has been using them since the beginning of the war. As a result, the people of Eastern Ghouta have been under heavy bombardment for the last 3 months, and they've all been living underground. And that was one of the other pictures that he painted for us, was life for 3 months underground in cellars, in small spaces with your entire family, leaving only for short minutes of the day to rush and try and get food or water before bringing it back. And that's why this gas was so effective in the dark cellars when it hit, was because a lot of it seeped down into these cellars. And in three houses where there was a direct hit with these barrel bombs, everyone in the house died. This was a region, an area of Damascus, which had been so heavily bombarded, and yet people had remained there in opposition, that this was the last straw. And actually, just days after the gas attack, a deal was done between the residents and the Russian government, not even the Syrian government, the Russian government, to finally evacuate. It was this gas attack that finally pushed them to leave. Even after months of bombardment by conventional weapons, this was the one that pushed them to leave. And so
all right, so the underground living for a lot of these has ended, but
right? And they've been able to flee, but where do they go?
Well, the deal done with the Russians was to give them safe passage to the north of the country, and that is also how we were able to interview them. So they are bussed out, including any rebel fighters who are there with their families. In this case, it was a few thousand fighters and their families, and they were bussed up north. And the Syrian regime has been doing this in various areas of the country for some time now. They surround, they starve, and they bombard communities for months on end until they have no other option but to leave. And what they've been doing is they've been moving them north, and they've been effectively taking them all to one place, Idlib province. And the great fear now is that that is the last bastion of opposition where all the rebel fighters have been put. And, of course, the great fear now is that Assad will go into Idlib and do what he's done elsewhere, effectively winning the war once and for all. So they've basically been moved all into one pocket of Syria.
So with that said, the U.S. does have different Syrian groups that we back, and I know that they're still out there. So how do they defend that area?
You know, it's going to be very hard. I mean, the U.S. does have some allies that it's worked with. The support for many of these groups, particularly within the FSA, that's the Free Syrian Army, has been scaled back a fair amount. So you speak to people on the ground, and what they say is they don't know what will prevent Assad's victory. They think that really there is little they can now do, because unless you have a massive influx of troops or you provide them with major weapons, then they simply can't defeat not the Syrian regime, but also the Russian government. And of course, when you speak to people, they always say, we're not just fighting Assad's regime, we're fighting the Russians. That was what swayed the balance of power in this conflict. And so, of course, the U.S. not willing to go face-to-face with any Russian elements in the country. And it looks like the FSA, some of those rebel groups, will just have to defend themselves as best as they can.
These inspectors with the OPCW, I guess they got in over the weekend, finally took some samples. But what's left that has been not cleansed?
You know, the Syrian regime and the Russians had delayed their entry to Douma. And you can only trace for many of these nerve agents for up to 2 weeks afterwards, at least in clothes and in soil samples. And they held them back for longer than 2 weeks. And so what they find on the ground is uncertain. We know that the Syrian government and the Russian have worked together to try and clear some of those areas. So it's unclear what they will find. However, we spoke to some doctors and some rebel commanders in the north of Syria who had helped get some of the survivors of the attack out. And they told us that Americans had come into that northern buffer zone to take both blood and urine samples. And so when you hear Nikki Haley and others in the U.S. say that they have evidence, we suspect that's how they've sent people into the north to take evidence directly from the survivors. And in the blood and in hair and in urine, that lasts a lot longer than the 2 weeks. So they have those samples, certainly.
And the people you spoke to, what is their feeling about America and what we're doing?
Of course, this all traces back to the red line as set by Obama in 2013, when there was a lot of hope that the U.S. would come on board from that point and sway the balance of power. That never happened. Almost a year ago exactly, the Syrian government used nerve agents in a town called Khan Sheikhoun, and we interviewed survivors of that as well. And that was when President Trump first used the Tomahawk missiles against them. And that gave many people in Syria an element of hope. Not a lot came after that. And then we had this other attack, again, more intervention by the Trump White House. But what they say is it's not enough. Especially these strikes were pinprick strikes. They were very targeted. They haven't changed anything on the ground itself. So they're grateful for the U.S. strikes. They certainly are. And they feel that they had been forgotten and maybe this reminded the international community. But they do say it's not enough. We do need more help moving forward. But the overwhelming belief by most is that it's too late, that Assad and his Russian and Iranian backers have already won this conflict.
Benjamin Hall, you got a glimpse of a world that we don't get a chance to get to, and it's very difficult. And thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Download and subscribe to original podcast from Fox News Radio.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.
Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcast.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Jessica Tarlow. Jessica Tarlow.
What's on your mind?
This was first printed on bustle.com. When I was asked to write this piece, I immediately started thinking about what my angle would be.
Several excellent reviews of James Comey's book, A Higher Loyalty, are already circulating. As for me, I haven't worked in the intelligence community. I'm not a lawyer. What I do know is how to analyze and conduct polls and how to read national sentiment and the political landscape in America. It is in that space that I see the lasting impact of Comey's book, Cultural Decay. This isn't a partisan issue. I have no problem with Democrats looking bad because of the book. If there's more to the Loretta Lynch story, let's hear it. And I would hope that those on the Republican side are concerned that this president can so easily be described as, quote, unethical and untethered to truth and institutional values, as Comey puts it. We have become a society where our institutions have been so demeaned, our level of discourse so lowered, our citizenry so clickbait-obsessed that a man like James Comey, who has honorably dedicated his life to public service, felt the need to write a book that puts him in the same space as Michael Wolff. We have become a society that deserves a petulant presidency devoid of ethics. The trappings have been there for a while. There's a reason millions thought a reality TV star would be a good choice for leader of the free world. It's not because we're doing well. But I firmly believe that Donald Trump is the molten center of our cultural decay. He brings the quality of our great nation down with each stroke of the keyboard. He debases our values and way of life. The result? People far better than Trump engage with him at his level, and we end up with people like Comey serving as mere fodder for Twitter wars. Indeed, the fact that a guy like Comey thought that writing this book was essential proves out that Trump has brought down the best of us. We're discussing salacious details from A Higher Loyalty as we would from Ed Klein's The Amateur. Of course, that doesn't mean that Comey's book isn't better written, better researched, and offers more to society. But it does signify that yet another great American public servant now subscribes to Trump's theory of counterpunching. Comey is not alone. Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush tried out immature nicknames during the Republican primary. Paul Ryan has been humiliated every which way. Gary Cohn will go down in history as the guy who drew the line at tariffs, not anti-Semitism and racism. I hate what Comey did to Hillary. I have little sympathy for any sense of guilt he may have about the effect of his decisions on her candidacy. And though Comey's tale is interesting, I cringe when I see his name tarred across Trump's Twitter account like he was one of the president's favorite fake news reporters. Trump is making us all counterpunchers, and it's a terrible look for the nation. This is Jessica Tarlow.
You have been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to Fox News Radio's hourly newscast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, visit foxnews.com.